Hello, everyone, and welcome to the TMA Ask the Expert podcast series. We're a nonprofit focused on support, education, and research of rare neuroimmune disorders. You can learn more about us on our website at myelitis.org. Today is an open forum on transverse myelitis, including acute flaccid myelitis, neuromyelitis optica spectrum disorder, optic neuritis, and ADEM, with TMA Deng T. Lubin Fellows, Dr. Alan DeSena and Dr. Michael Sweeney. Dr. Alan DeSena is a pediatric neurologist who, during his residency at UT Southwestern Medical Center and Children's Medical Center, Dallas, developed an interest in transverse myelitis and other rare neuroimmune disorders. In 2012, he was the recipient of the first James T. Lubin Fellowship Award from the TMA to pursue a clinical and research career in transverse myelitis and other related disorders. He is the first neurology fellow to study the rare spectrum of neuroimmune disorders with a particular focus on TM. Dr. DeSena sees both adults and children in his neurology practice currently at Cincinnati. Dr. Michael Sweeney is also a pediatric neurologist who completed his residency training in child neurology at Cincinnati Children's Hospital. He then moved to Salt Lake City, where he is currently finishing up the TMA James T. Lubin Fellowship in autoimmune neurology at the University of Utah. He will be joining the pediatric neurology group at the University of Louisville, Kentucky later this year, actually next month, and is looking forward to starting a neuroimmunology practice at Cosair Children's Hospital. He also sees both adults and children in his practice. Thank you, Dr. Sweeney, and thank you, Dr. DeSena, for joining us today.
Thank you.
For our listeners, this podcast is being recorded and will be made available on the TMA website. During the call, if you have any additional questions, please message us through the chat option available with GoToWebinar, or you could also message us on Facebook if you'd like. To start off this podcast, Dr. DeSena, could you give us an overview on rare neuroimmune disorders? What are they, and what distinguishes TM, AFM, NMOSD, and ADEM in the spectrum?
So, rare immunologic disorders are a group of disorders that are acquired disorders. They are paroxysmal, so they tend to start very suddenly over a period of days to weeks, and involve, depending on which disorder you're referring to, a situation where the immune system of the individual gets confused and starts to cause inflammation in areas of the central transverse myelitis, that is usually the spinal cord. For NMO spectrum disease, that means that you can get inflammation in the spinal cord or the optic nerves most commonly. For ADEM or ADEM, or acute disseminated encephalomyelitis, you can get inflammation in various parts of the brain and or spinal cord. And for acute flaccid myelitis or AFM, you tend to get inflammation in a very specific part of the spinal cord that tends to cause a very specific pattern of weakness in which there is low tone and profound weakness. And it's thought to be a variant or possibly a subtype of what is considered more classic transverse myelitis. In several of these disorders, specifically ADEM or ADEM, what is considered classic or typical idiopathic transverse myelitis and acute flaccid myelitis, they're usually considered to be a one-time event where they cause issues in the areas that they cause issues in. And depending on how well the patient may, in terms of what therapies they get, they tend to not have a recurrence, which differentiates them from NMO spectrum disorders, where NMO is thought to be a recurrent disorder, sort of like MS, but distinct in several different ways, and requires a different treatment strategy long term. They have the, all these disorders share some common denominators with respect to the acute treatment that's usually offered with variable degrees of recovery, depending, that varies from patient to patient and across different disease types. We know these are disorders that we're still learning a lot about, specifically acute rhabdomyolysis, how we better understand and define transverse myelitis, and even ADM or ADEM as well. And there has been also a lot of research specifically in NMO spectrum disorders more recently.
That's great, thank you. So Dr. Sweeney, you know, Dr. DeSena talked about sort of how these different disorders will, you know, could have different treatments. Would you be willing to give us an overview of what the various groups of treatment strategies are for these disorders during an acute attack?
Sure. So when somebody presents with one of these syndromes, depending on which one, we often base our acute treatment based on the symptoms that they're having, the severity of the symptoms that they're having, and other comorbidities that they may have. The mainstay of acute treatments in these disorders tends to fall with three different treatments. So one, the most common is high-dose IV steroids. These are usually given, the treatments use allumetrol 1 gram, or the child goes by their weight. We treat for anywhere from 3 to 5 days, sometimes longer, depending on severity of symptoms and how well they're responding. Another treatment that we use in the acute setting is IVIG, or pooled human immunoglobulin. This is also given through the IV. And this treatment, and some people will give this treatment over one treatment, or sometimes we split this up over 5 days and give this in the acute setting. And then the other acute treatment that we use is something called plasmapheresis, or plasma exchange. This involves getting a large central line placed, usually in the neck, and then the blood is pulled out of the body, run through a series of filters, and then placed back into the body through a different IV. And this is usually done once a day, every other day, for anywhere from 4 to 6, sometimes more, treatments. And then as more is learned about some of these diseases, there are other therapies that are starting to be used in the acute setting, things like rituximab and cyclophosphamide. But I guess we'll talk about those a little bit later.
So this is actually a question from the UK, Dr. DeSena. I wonder if you could take that. He says he has NMO, was diagnosed in 2006, has had 5 relapses in that year, was given azathioprine, which was ineffective, IV steroids and plasma exchange. After 8 good years without a relapse, having only rituximab approximately every 10 months, he suffered further inflammation of the spinal cord in 2006, earlier this year, 2016. The rituximab treatment was brought forward, and now I will have infusions on a 6-monthly basis. However, about 5 to 6 weeks ago, I noticed further symptoms and was given a large dose of oral prednisolone. This dose is being tapered down to 10 milligrams. I think the question you'd like to ask is there anything else available, maybe in the UK, other than rituximab, that is another monoclonal antibody, or anything else, not the methotrexate, that has been successfully tested in the U.S. to treat NMO? Dr. DeSena?
So a little bit of a difficult question to answer in terms of what's going on with him right now. So in general, what I can say is, so rituximab is generally infused probably on average every 6 months or so. What I usually recommend, now, how it's different ways it's infused. So, and I just want to mention this just because it's a common question I get in relation to rituximab in general. So some people will give a one-time dose, some people give a for adults, we'll give 1,000 milligrams. Some people will give a dose of 1,000 milligrams every 2 weeks for a month. Some people will give a smaller dose once weekly for 4 weeks. In all of those regimens, the goal is to render the B cells absent, essentially, from the peripheral blood, which is how we monitor it. And so we usually check something called CD19 after the rituximab infusion, and then once monthly. Once the CD19 count starts to creep up, usually more than about 1%, for NMO patients, we use reinfusing before it even gets above that 1% threshold, because the unpredictability of the relapse is occurring if the patient is responding. In general, most patients the effects of the medication will last roughly around 6 months on average. But everyone's a little bit different. So some people will show evidence of B cell suppression for longer. What I typically do not recommend is blindly treating with rituximab without checking the CD19 count, because if someone has a relapse and you don't know if it's already washed out in terms of its effect, then you don't really know if the relapse is because the rituximab has washed out or if it's actually failure of the rituximab. The rituximab has fairly good evidence, although no formal clinical trials for specifically NMO, in terms of what we know based on theories, retrospective reviews, et cetera. Depending on the severity of the patient's disease, there are other options that can be considered. So azathioprine is an oral medication that we sometimes use. And some of the older data, some providers are still doing this, they sometimes will give azathioprine with a low dose of steroids. The only problem with this, from my standpoint, is I typically like to try to avoid keeping patients on long-term steroids, even at low dose, to avoid long-term steroid side effects. However, if patients are doing well on this regimen and otherwise tolerating it okay, then it could be fine. Another oral medication that can be tried is a medication called mycophenolate mofetil, which is an oral medication, usually dosed twice daily, that's used in transplant rejection. And there's fairly good data for this as well. In general, and this is personal preference, I usually, if the patient has done pretty well with their disease course with NMO, I usually would try mycophenolate mofetil first, if it can be acquired. If the patient has a breakthrough relapse on that, then I usually consider another agent. If a patient has breakthrough symptoms, the first issue to assess is whether that's indicative of a new neurologic event. And so sometimes patients can have, for example, a bad infection. So sometimes they can have an upper respiratory infection or a sinus, or even like a urinary tract infection. And they can get resurgence of old neurologic symptoms. And then oftentimes we will image them and everything looks stable. There's nothing new. And it is fairly well known and established that an infection can cause old symptoms to resurface, both in NMO, and this actually happens quite frequently in MS. But in that case, there's no new damage occurring. And so usually the first step is, if the patient's having clearly new neurologic symptoms, then I usually recommend it for them to touch base with their primary neurologist to see if he or she would like to assess them and or check them for evidence of infection, et cetera. if they get a if it looks clearly new and they have an MRI that shows new evidence of new inflammation, then going back to whatever therapy they're on, then it needs to be assessed if it's because of failure of the therapy. If a patient's already failed a medication such as azathioprine and they're on rituximab, then one of the questions to answer, if they're on rituximab, especially if it's been a while since they've been infused, is did they have a breakthrough event because of the rituximab effects have washed out? And usually that's usually answered by a pretty simple what. If it looks like the effects of the rituximab have not washed out and the rituximab appears to be doing what it's doing, then first things first, in the patient needs to be treated for the acute relapse with either steroids or the other things that Dr. Sweeney mentioned just prior. And then there needs to be discussion about between the patient and their neurologist about what other acute therapy should be considered. On a quick side note, there are actually three ongoing clinical trials right now for new therapies for NMO that are open to adults in the United States. I don't know specifically what the status of those is with respect to the United Kingdom is. But there are three trials that are ongoing. There is another off-label at this time medication called tocilizumab that has been used with some success with patients that have not responded well to other medications for neuromyelitis optica. And right now, that medication is considered off-label, although, of course, right now, technically speaking, all the medications to prevent relapses in NMO are considered off-label. So it's no different with respect to that. The medication can be difficult to get approved in the United States. I'm not sure how difficult it would be to get it approved in the United Kingdom. So that's what I would recommend in terms of an overview of how NMO relapses and events are managed with respect to the patient calling and saying, I'm having new symptoms.
Thank you. That was very comprehensive. Thank you. You referred to the clinical trials, Dr. DeSena. Would you be able to share a little bit about what these three trials are?
I'm not directly involved with any of these trials, and so what the all of the medications are fairly newer therapies. One of them is related to B cell function, sort of like rituximab, but quite a bit different in terms of thought to be a little bit more effective in terms of knocking out more of the B cells, et cetera. And then there's another medication that keys on the type of target with all complement. And complement are these little proteins that are released by the immune cells that help stimulate other aspects of the immune system. I'm not directly involved with those trials, so I can't really speak to the status of where they all are in relation to how far they are from ending and the people looking at the data, et cetera.
Great, thank you. And for our listeners, we do have these trials listed on our website. Anyone's interested in learning more about the trial in terms of what the enrollment criteria are and where the sites are for enrollment, please visit our website. It's myelitis.org. Changing topics a little bit from NMO, moving to the question of management of pain. Dr. Sweeney, we get this asked a lot, and a lot of members in our community have questions about neuropathic pain. What is it, and how does one manage it?
Yeah, so after the acute phase of the disease is gone, the symptoms that are left are what we are left to deal with for a long time, and so pain is probably among all these disorders the most common thing that we're left to deal with. Neuropathic pain specifically refers to pain that is caused by irritation or damage to nerves themselves, peripheral nerves. I'm going to clump myelopathic pain into that same kind of category. which would be caused by damage to the spinal cord. This pain differs from other types of pain in its description and how it responds to different medications. So neuropathic pain typically responds poorly to classic pain medications in the opiate families and in the non-steroidal anti-inflammatory medication families. So I will talk about different medications that we have and to treat this type of pain, and then I'll also talk a little bit about other methods that we use to try to help people with these types of symptoms. So for the pharmacologic management, I'll break it down into different categories. So the first category are the anti-epileptic medications. These are typically first-line medications when treating neuropathic pain. Included in this group, I would include gabapentin or pregabalin, which are usually the first medications we'll try. And these act centrally to try to modulate the pain pathways and are overall pretty effective with fairly mild side effects. It's not uncommon to hear that these medications help with the pain symptoms, but they will not take the pain all the way away. Other anti-epileptics that we sometimes try include topiramate. More and more we're starting to use lamotrigine. Phenytoin is sometimes used. So overall, these medications work pretty well. More specific to treatment of myelopathic pain or other certain specific neuropathic pain syndromes like trigeminal neuralgia, we'll use carbamazepine or oxcarbazepine, which are fairly effective at treatment of those symptoms. Outside of the anti-epileptic family, we use antidepressants. And included in this group are some of the old antidepressants called tricyclic antidepressants. In this family, we have things like amitriptyline or nortriptyline, imipramine or doxepin. These are also used, they can be used first line, but oftentimes they're used as adjuvant therapy on top of the anti-epileptic. And sometimes they're thought to have a synergistic effect, meaning that they help on top of, you know, the combination is better than one, either medication alone. Most commonly in children, we'll use amitriptyline as they tolerate the side effects a little bit better than in adults. And so those medicines are used fairly commonly. And then in the newer antidepressant medication families, we have things like venlafaxine and duloxetine. And those medicines are starting to be used more and more frequently as well. So outside of oral pharmacologic management, we have other things that we sometimes try. So things like topical treatments, like topical lidocaine, if there's a certain small area that is affected. It wouldn't be an optimal therapy for if you had generalized pain, but sometimes we get some good relief with using it locally. I think an underutilized form of treatment for neuropathic pain is actually not pharmacologic, but actually therapy. So there's a growing body of evidence showing that things like biofeedback and therapy sessions can actually be very beneficial in modulating these pain symptoms and help people cope quite well with having chronic pain. When these things fail, we sometimes refer to pain specialists, which can be very beneficial. And they're truly the experts at fine-tuning pain regimens and helping us to overcome some of the side effects and manage these things over a long time. I don't know if you had any more specific questions about that, Chitra.
No, that's fantastic overview. Thank you for covering the breadth of medications and non-pharmacological options available. We just got a question in from our community. says, I'm a 68-year-old woman. I had an attack of TM in December 2014. In the space of a day, I lost sensation and strength in my right leg. I was admitted to the hospital, but the diagnosis wasn't made for 2 weeks. Since then, I've recovered some strength in the leg, but still have weakness, neuropathy, and paresthesias. The doctors keep telling me I'd get better, but I plateaued a year ago and I've gotten no better. Is there any therapy for me? Dr. DeSena, would you like to start with this one?
So sometimes it's a little bit difficult to speak specifically about one patient's experience, but just from a general standpoint, a couple of things. So when a patient comes to me that carries a diagnosis of transverse myelitis, then usually the first question I ask is, did they have transverse myelitis? So assuming that diagnosis is correct, then a lot of the focus once you're a year farther out is focusing on aspects of rehabilitation specifically that can better optimize recovery and therapy. And so usually this requires a very extensive discussion about pain issues, fatigue, energy issues, bladder and bowel dysfunction, and sometimes mood, because a lot of these things will have a very profound impact on the patient's recovery and their ability to recover function in their lives. With some of the symptoms, this is true for TM or an ADEM and even NMO patients and even the MS patients I see, is that loss of sensation symptoms are sometimes difficult to get back. Sometimes if there's not a lot of pain, meaning that burning pain, that tingling pain, or any kind of pain, and they find that there's a loss of sensation to a certain degree and it's irritating, then what I usually would say is that we will try some of the medications for neuropathic pain specifically, but sometimes it's hard to relieve that problem. The weakness, once you're a year farther out, depends on the area of weakness and depends upon what they're doing with their rehab physician or their rehabilitation team. And specifically, what they're focusing on. So as an example, are they in need of bracing? Do they have what they call dorsiflexor weakness or weakness with their ankles and they're in need of bracing? Are they in need of a what we call core muscle strengthening? So core muscle strengthening, so strengthening the muscles of your abdomen and lower back, and things like that are very helpful for, are very important for walking for everyone, but they can be specifically affected in a lot of TM patients, and those kinds of muscle groups are not that easy to work out. You need a regimen specifically that focuses on that. I encourage everyone, if it's possible, if they're running into it, a point where they're plateauing with their recovery, to get involved with a physical medicine physician. So a physician that's all they do is focus on rehabilitation. Now, there are different rehab doctors, just like there are different orthopedic surgeons, for example. So you have orthopedic surgeons that focus on knees or in shoulders, et cetera. And so there are different rehab doctors that have more familiarity with patients with spinal cord injuries and less familiarity with patients with spinal cord injuries. What I encourage patients to do with respect to, because I just mentioned the term spinal cord injuries, is what you encourage them to do if they say, well, I talked to a rehab doctor and they said that they're not sure about transverse myelitis, et cetera. And what I tell them is that they should use the term spinal cord injury because transverse myelitis causes spinal cord injury, and so usually that's a term that they're a little bit more familiar with, and so any physical medicine rehab doctor, or I would say most, that manage patients with spinal cord injury should be very competent to manage a patient that had a transverse myelitis event.
And so with respect to the patient-specific question, those are the kinds of things I probably would focus on to target with their neurologist and or the rehab physician as they move forward with their care.
Thank you. And actually continuing another question for you, Dr. DeSena. This is about spasms. Someone from our community wrote to us and said, I am trying to control these seizures by taking isoniazid and Nikinta 4 times a day, yet I still have them at least once a day, especially if I overdo. Do you know of a more effective treatment? He has TM and also a peripheral nerve disorder, both caused by an overactive immune system, he says.
So it depends upon the nature of the, so a lot of the muscle spasms with TM patients, and oftentimes the NMO patients tend to be worse at night, or sometimes tripped by activity, like he or she said. One of the things they can do that's non-pharmacologic is they can do daily stretching. So daily stretching of the lower extremities, usually it's involving the lower extremities, of the muscle groups that tend to be involved, and also specifically before bedtime, can work at least to modulate the symptoms to some degree. Some patients that have been not particularly severe will say that stretching in and of itself, a good stretching, and I'm talking about a good 5 to 15 minutes of stretching those muscle groups pretty well, will some patients will say that it provides significant relief. A lot of the patients I'll ask specifically about, especially if having sleep issues, if muscle spasms are affecting their ability to fall asleep and or stay asleep. And by muscle spasms, I mean episodes where the muscle gets tight and hurts, kind of like a trolley horse, and or if there's involuntary jerks that are painful. I have personally found success with carbamazepine, which is one of the seizure medications Dr. Sweeney mentioned, with a fair amount of both TM patients and NMO patients with those types of muscle spasms. And sometimes I'll just dose it at night just to see how it works. The tizanidine is a good medication that can work for some certain patients. Sometimes I usually would just give it at night specifically because it tends to be somewhat sedating. So I tend to avoid trying to give it during the day unless the patients have already proven they can tolerate it. Baclofen is another medication that sometimes will dose for this problem. With patients, when they do respond to them, to getting to patients that have, well, I get some relief with whatever medication it is, XYZ medication. And then they say, they come in, they said, well, I'll go on it for a few days, and then they kind of calm down, and then I'll go off of it, and then they kind of flare up, and then what do I do? If those kinds of symptoms, and this happens with a lot of the pain symptoms too, it's very, because they can oscillate. And there are some patients that have more steady symptoms where they kind of know they have to be on something every day. But some of the patients is very episodic. And so what I usually say is if we can't really target or predict when it's going to occur, then you probably are going to have to be on something every day if it's working well. Obviously, you want to find something, A, that's working well, and B, that can be tolerated. They don't feel like it's too sedating. They can generally do what they need to do to function. They can take care of their family, their kids, work, whatever responsibilities they have. And there's not causing any side effects that are either uncomfortable or influencing their ability to function. And so I usually say you probably have to be on something daily. What I try to avoid with the patients, and this is true with both pain issues, muscle spasm issues, it can be true with bladder and bowel issues, is going on and off the medications. Though I understand people don't like to take medications, that's a normal human thing to not want to be on a lot of medications. If the symptoms are unpredictable, then you often have to be on something more scheduled in order to keep them managed to a comfortable degree. And of course, my goal for all patients, regardless of the symptoms, muscle spasms, et cetera, is to keep them on as few agents as possible, they're tolerated and works well with their schedule, and they can function well on them.
Thank you. And what about baclofen pumps for spasms, Dr. DeSena?
Depending on the patient, at some point, and this happens with some TM patients, NMO patients, NAP with MS patients, depending on how many medications they have tried and not responded well to, sometimes we'll bring up the possibility of using a baclofen pump. Now, the baclofen pump can be extraordinarily effective. There's a couple of things to consider is that usually they have to work well. It's usually either rehab physicians or sometimes it's pain management specialists, but oftentimes it's coming rehab physicians, which are also called podiatrists, and it involves placing hardware within the patient's body, but it can be quite effective. What I usually recommend is usually not going down that route unless it is extraordinarily severe, and it's also proven that the symptoms have proven refractory, meaning not responding well to treatment to at least a few agents. And then I usually will encourage them to talk it over with a provider that manages the baclofen pumps. The baclofen pumps have the added advantage of because you're not taking something systemically, of possibly having good symptom control with respect to the muscle spasms, with less side effects related to taking baclofen scheduled or tizanidine scheduled or any other agent.
Thank you. Switching gears a little bit to ADEM, we have a question from a mom asking a couple of questions for her son. Dr. Sweeney, be grateful if you'd take these. My son has an abnormal Babinski reflex that is present on the affected side. What does it mean, and should it improve over time? And a second part to this question is, does the MRI change over time? Do you see remyelination over time? And is it a third part, is it too late to get after a year and a half? During the acute attack, her son only got steroids. Dr. Sweeney?
Sure. So ADEM, or acute disseminated encephalomyelitis, is thought to be a monophasic, meaning it happens one time and then a recovery period after that. It's an inflammatory attack on the brain and spinal cord. So the first part of this question, your son has an abnormal Babinski reflex. So a Babinski reflex is a reflex that we test, and it involves scratching the bottom of the foot and noting how the toes move in response to that scratch on the bottom of the foot. In a child less than about 18 months, that reflex where the toes go up, which would be called an abnormal Babinski reflex, that's actually normal in that age group. So as the brain matures and grows and the myelin forms around the nerve, that response where the toes go up actually reverses and will go down. So in an adult or an older child, the toe should go down when we scratch the foot. Anytime that there's an insult to the brain or spinal cord, we can see that Babinski reflex becomes abnormal. So the toes will start to go up again. And that tells us that one sign on the physical exam that can tell us that there's something happening in the central nervous system. So that in and of itself is not diagnostic for ADEM, but tells us that there's something wrong with the... oftentimes, we will see that reflex become normal again over time, although not in all cases. So there are patients who have multiple sclerosis, for example, who will have an abnormal Babinski reflex for many years. I do have some patients with ADEM who have brisk reflexes or abnormal reflexes that do not improve over time. So ADEM in and of itself is thought to be monophasic. And so lots of times we will follow, we check an MRI at the initial presentation and we note what abnormalities are present. And then over time we do expect in that disease process for some of that inflammation to get better on the imaging. In most cases, the imaging will return to normal or near normal, meaning most of the abnormalities that we see at the acute presentation will not be detectable after a certain amount of period of time. There are some patients who have residual abnormalities on their imaging, depending on the severity of the attack. It can vary in severity. So the brain will remyelinate over time. The way I was taught is that the remyelination is never as good as the original myelin that was laid down during brain development. And so sometimes you can still see that abnormality on the imaging despite symptoms having gone away several years down the road, even after the initial insult. The question where is it too late to get another treatment after 1 to 2 years after the acute treatment? That's a kind of a complex question, and there are a lot of ifs in terms of how well did her son initially respond to steroids, and what are we trying to treat now with further treatment almost 2 years later? I would say in most cases, additional immunotherapy is not warranted that much later after the initial presentation, unless there's concern that this is something else, such as a second attack or another attack of demyelination, such as would be seen in multiple sclerosis. While immunotherapy may not be warranted, other treatments can be very effective. So other things, so treating symptoms, such as Dr. Senna was talking about with spasticity, treating pain, and also having an aggressive rehab regimen where we're treating with aggressive physical therapy, occupational therapy, things like that are very effective even 2-3 years out. And often patients have needs that go much farther out than that. So while immunotherapy may not be warranted that much later, there are definitely many things that you can be doing to improve your functional outcomes even that far out.
That's great. Thank you. This question just came in from one of our listeners. I have been told it is highly unusual to have a repeat inflammation in the same area of the spinal cord. After 8 months on CellCept, this is what has happened to me. Have you seen this before? Dr. DeSena?
Yeah. I guess it depends on what the in terms of the clinical context. There are some... if the patient is diagnosed with transverse myelitis, which is thought to be, so when people say transverse myelitis, they usually mean idiopathic transverse myelitis. Idiopathic means, is a fancy doctor word for meaning without clear cause, and usually it refers to a one-time event, myelitis event. If it's several months following the acute event and a patient comes in with what looks like evidence of new inflammation, then the diagnosis of idiopathic transverse myelitis should at least be reconsidered, and recurrent causes of transverse myelitis should be considered. And so NMO is one of those causes. There are some other causes that sometimes rheumatologic disorders can cause recurrent myelitis symptoms and recurrent inflammation in the same area of the spinal cord. There's a rare condition called sarcoidosis that can cause recurrence of inflammation in a certain part of the spinal cord. Those are probably some of the more common, but there are some other more rare causes as well. The one commonality that a lot of these share is that the acute therapies are often overlapped. So a lot of those patients will all respond to steroids acutely. It's where if it's truly a new event and several months following, then the question of what is the underlying cause needs to be investigated by the neurologist.
Thank you. Dr. Sweeney, this is a question that comes to us from Connecticut. Are there new therapies that will decrease the hypersensitivity that I feel when my legs touch metal, a hard surface, or water temperatures less than 95 degrees? I have TM and lesions between C2 and C4.
I think this question plays into what we talked about earlier with treatment of neuropathic and myelopathic pain. A lot of times with involvement of the spinal cord, you can have these symptoms where you have extreme hypersensitivity to even things that normally you would not even notice your body touching. So things like when you're walking, feeling the ground that you're walking on or having clothes on. So I tend to treat these symptoms as I would with pain symptoms, neuropathic pain symptoms. Oftentimes when it's a hypersensitivity issue or something that I'm thinking I can localize to the spinal cord, I will start with carbamazepine or oxcarbazepine. And those tend to bring the symptoms down somewhat, although I've been unsuccessful at fully getting rid of these symptoms. They tend to be very refractory to most treatments. I'm not aware of any new therapies per se that would specifically address these types of symptoms.
Thank you. Dr. DeSena, would you like to add anything to this question in terms of new therapies?
No, I agree with them. So the technical term for that type of pain system is allodynia, it can be very difficult. It's very unpredictable. It's patient by different for each patient, and I have had a few patients that I've seen. This is after the fact that had a lot of those problems that had spinal cord stimulators placed by pain providers. This was before I was involved with their care, and I've had a couple of patients say that helped with the hypersensitivity, but in general I would say that it seems to be a very difficult to manage symptom. It's every patient's different, so you know, I'll try multiple medications and we'll texture them up as long as they're tolerated to the highest dose that the patient can tolerate before we say, well, maybe that's not working, et cetera. It's just very patient-specific.
Thank you. And switching gears, actually, and this question touches on several of the points you both talked about, but I'm going to repeat one of our community members' questions. She says, my husband was diagnosed with TM in 2005. He is walking again. He does suffer from severe pain in back and legs mostly. Is there any therapy that would help with this? Also, we heard there has been stem cell research that proved maybe helpful. How does this work? You both talked about the different therapies for pain. Switching gears a little bit, talking about research. Dr. DeSena, would you like to start us off and share about some of the research you're working on? And then specifically to this question, has there been any stem cell research that has been conducted that could prove helpful?
One of the research projects I'm involved in is a research project in conjunction with the TMA and University of Texas Southwestern called the CAPTCHA study that we are in waiting for IRB approval. And this is a looking at pediatric patients with TM and tracking them over time with multiple evaluation methods to have a better understanding of the course of transverse myelitis in the first 1 year following diagnosis. I'm working with a couple of providers that on research projects that are still in the planning stages with respect to working with the ophthalmologist on patients that have had optic neuritis and in some projects in the pre-planning stages, and work with another provider and a basic scientist on looking at these are a little more complex, but basic science mechanisms behind not only transverse myelitis, but other related disorders such as MS, NMO, et cetera. So that's sort of, we're sort of in the planning stages. Unfortunately, the pace of research, depending on whatever center you're at, is slower than, the process can be a little bit slow depending on the project and depending on the other scientists you're working with. With regards to stem cell therapy, I'm not currently involved with any stem cell therapy projects. I know there was a recent result in the news in the popular media about patients that had stem cell therapy that had suffered a stroke in their brain that they seem to have promising results. However, the numbers in that study were small. It appears to potentially be promising. We're still, meaning the teammate community, we're still looking for options moving forward in terms of what kind of project would be a well-designed project that would answer that question whether stem cell therapy would be a potential option for patients.
Thank you. Dr. Sweeney, is there any research that you're working on that you would like to share with us?
Sure. So I'll start with talking about the stem cell therapy that research that has been going on is focused mainly on multiple sclerosis. There's been two large trials involving that patient population, some of which in the future may be extrapolated to other demyelinating diseases, but really at this time it's been focused on reducing relapse risk. So when you're looking for research that is targeting therapy or improvement following demyelination, there's a lot of research ongoing, mostly still in the basic science realm, looking at remyelination pathways. There are a lot of exciting compounds far along in the pipeline, but still below the phase one trial levels. So we'll be anticipating those compounds coming out in the next several years. Me personally, so as I finish my fellowship and start up my clinic in Louisville, I will be starting my research database and getting collaboration going. As you can imagine, it's quite a hectic time to be starting any projects at the current time. We are looking at trying to better define transverse myelitis. I think as a community, we've struggled with research in the past because of how ambiguous some of the diagnoses are. So currently here, we're looking at a large database of patients in the VA system. I'm trying to better characterize how those patients present, what age, and how they responded to certain treatments, what parts of their spinal cord are affected, and other kind of clinical aspects of their care. Hopefully that will add to some knowledge about the prevalence, incidence of this disease, and hopefully we can extrapolate some of that information and help to better define the diagnostic criteria for transverse myelitis. There should be a lot to come in the next several years. It's an exciting time in the field.
Fantastic. Thank you. Thank you both for your time, for sharing your thoughts and answering questions from our community. We're really grateful to both of you for devoting your career to studying these rare neuroimmune disorders. And I'm also thankful to our community for supporting our mission so we can continue to train more physicians and researchers like you both in the field and be able to help people more in the future. Thank you again.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chitra.